So tonight we begin our week-long Vipassana retreat. We'd like to welcome those of you who've just arrived. You know who people are? This is Ursula. I'm Carol. Fred's back there somewhere. And this is Isis Vienzano. For those of you who've been here, she's joining us for this next week. She'll be part of our teaching team. Good. All right, that's it. You all know how to practice, right? So I just, tonight, just a few reflections that occurred to me, maybe just as a way of hopefully turning our hearts' minds towards awareness practice, towards the Dhamma, just a few things. In those of us who've been here for this week, starting tonight, tomorrow morning, we'll be shifting the style of meditation from the focusing of the metta, from the one-pointedness of cultivating the heart mind of friendliness, to our moment-to-moment awareness practice. Basically, one way you could say it's not really accurate is opening the heart mind of friendliness to meet whatever's naturally arising in any of the six sense doors. It's our practice. Just to talk a bit about that. To start with just the biggest sense of the reason for doing this in terms of the Buddha's teaching. You know, this path, the path of awakening, is vast, right? It's huge. It encompasses all aspects of our life. And there's that lovely saying from the suttas of Ehipassika, please come and see for yourself. It's vast, but we're all invited. And just want to start by reminding us all of the big frame of reference within which we can experience all of the things that happen, the big frame of reference that the Buddha offered of the Four Noble Truths. I'm just going to mention them. This isn't a talk about the Four Noble Truths. But just this reminder, really, of at least for me, why we're doing what we're doing. Not, you know, to have better mindfulness. And in a way, it's more than the metta or any of the Brahma-Vihara practices. They lead into this vast wisdom. But in terms of a one-pointed practice, the trajectory is a little bit more narrow. So in terms of Vipassana, insight, awareness practice, it's really to live, understand our experience in the light of the Four Noble Truths, which is meant to free our heart and mind. So just a reminder, the first truth being that of dukkha, the unreliability, the unsatisfactory nature of all experience, as the Buddha spoke about it. As Bhikkhu Anālayo likes to translate it as a kind of a, things don't really quite work well. Like a, you know, it just doesn't quite, he calls it friction maybe. He talks about using the word dukkha, one of the translations could be from when they have the old ox carts, they have these big wooden wheels. Not with spokes like we, but just a big wooden wheel with just a hole cut in the middle that the axle goes through. And so it doesn't really turn very smoothly. And I've ridden in one of these ox carts, and they're killers, I'll tell you. They are not smooth. So it's really this kind of rough, it just doesn't really work. So that aspect of the obvious that pain and suffering exists, which is obvious, but the truth is just, this is just how it is. It's not something you're doing wrong when it happens. The other aspect of there's beautiful, there's pleasant, there's being united with what we love, and it always goes away. So there's being united with what we don't want to be united with, and not being united with what we do want to be united with. The fact of constant change, that's the unreliability. And then on a more subtle level, kind of the unending, repetitive nature that all the six senses just never give us a break. Every day you get up and you brush your teeth and you brush your hair if you have any and go to the bathroom and you eat and then you go to the bathroom again and then you wash, you know, it's just on and on. Now, that's just how it is. It doesn't mean there needs to be aversion to any of that. He's just saying this is just how it is. The second truth being what he calls, now I'm going to quote, the origination of our suffering. It's not that this stuff happens. It's the craving, that quality, tanha translated closer as thirst, that makes for, I'm quoting now from the suttas, that makes for further becoming. This craving, accompanied by passion and delight, enjoying, seeking, now here and now there. I love that. As a description, it's really craving, yes. It's accompanied by delight, enjoying, looking here, looking there. This is going to make me happy. And that's the cause of our suffering. That is craving for sense pleasures, craving for becoming, for states, for being, craving for non-becoming, which is often seen as the craving for things to go away. So the craving is both the wanting and the aversion, the push-pull that leads to our confused, irrelevant, suffering reactions, responses to experience. So this is the cause of suffering, according to the Buddha. The third, and again, the ending of suffering, again, I'm quoting from the suttas, the remainderless, fading, and cessation, or ending, the renunciation, the relinquishment, which means just the giving up, the release and letting go of that very craving. That's a lot of ways one could understand that. So I just want to say that this is where it gets really interesting in terms of our practice and how our mind or your mind might relate to the possibility of opening to that this is a possibility in our life, in our mind, in our heart. The remainderless fading and cessation, the relinquishment, the release and letting go of that very craving. That's spoken about, you know, in various ways in the suttas and with many teachers. And one, of course, is the complete, the absolute remainderless extinction of greed, aversion, and delusion, such that it never again arises in our mind stream, in our heart stream. That's the so-called arhat. So that's said to be a possibility. But the other way is we get glimpses of that on the way. So if we're just sitting here going, well, that's hopeless, forget about it, that's not very inspiring, really, is it? In terms of onward leading, in terms of motivation to do this difficult practice. But often, many teachers talk about, in fact, Sayadaw Upandita, who is one of the more very traditional Burmese teachers and very demanding, but he also, along with many other teachers in other Buddhist traditions, talk about how a moment of mindfulness is a moment of freedom. A moment that, remember, there's not, the mind heart is arising and changing from moment to moment. Our mind heart is not some steady state object that, you know, things arise and pass in, and so the mind is filled with greed and tanha, and then at some point it switches and it's empty of that. It's arising and passing every moment, as those of you who've been here hopefully saw in the metta, you know. It's every moment slightly different. That's the saving thing. So change is not only possible, it's impossible not to happen. And so there are moments, as Upandita is saying, moments when the heart mind is free from these kalesa, from tanha. And when there's awareness and presence with it, we can just get a taste of that. What that freedom is, as Ajahn Buddhadasa, the Thai meditation forest monk would talk about, nibbana for everyone. It's the natural state of the coolness of heart and mind that's not burning with the fire of Kalesa, not burning with the fire of greed, of hatred, of confusion. And he said, we all have many moments of that, or we die. We couldn't bear it if we were burning with Kalesa all the time. But we don't notice them a lot. With awareness, we can start to notice that. A moment of wakefulness, of non-clinging. This is from the Sutta. I've just been loving this line recently. It's from a different sutta. We're just inclining the heart, the mind, towards even the sense of this coolness, this peace, knowing it's possible, recognizing when it occurs. The Buddha is saying, part of our practice is really knowing how the kalesas work, but part is inclining towards this peace. You know, this is peace. This is exquisite. The stilling of all fabrications, all conglomerations, all constructions of mind. The relinquishment of all acquisitions, of all things that are gained. The ending of craving, disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, nirvana. It just makes me so, this is so exquisite. Just inclining towards the peace and stillness. Just let that in once in a while. And then notice how different it feels when we're going, this is wonderful. If I can only get this thing that I want, it'll be so good. If I get this metta, if I get this car, wow, this is accompanied by delight, searching now here and now there. That's really making me happy. Or this is exquisite. This is peace. So just letting in that possibility, the third noble truth. It's just even knowing that it's possible is, as the Buddha says, the noble follower of the way has this sense, okay, I'm paraphrasing, has the sense of this clear, luminous, shining quality of heart and mind, even though it's often hidden, obscured, colored by tanha, by craving. There are times when this clarity, this shining luminosity, this peace shines through. And because the noble follower of the way really understands this, for them there is development of the mind, cultivation of the heart. And that's, of course, the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, which I just listed. I'm sure you know it. Wise view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right virya or energy, right mindfulness, right collectedness, samadhi. Because there's moments of that glimpse of the peace that's possible when we're not in the throes, in the grips of tanha, there's cultivation. And that's hopefully why we're here. Certainly why I'm here cultivating. I hope that's why you're here. But it's really profound and I find beautiful. And it's a natural state. I find deeply inspiring the Four Noble Truths, this way of really understanding and meeting all aspects of our life rather than being a problem, as being as we understand how things work. This is this understanding of dukkha, the first truth, is what frees our mind. It's not that we have to change it. We can't change it. It's, oh, that's really how it is. The heart mind stops fighting. It's possible to recognize reality as it is, and that's the path to freedom. So I find it both deeply inspiring, but as I said, it's vast, right? There can be times it's a little bit daunting. You know, daunting is like, seems like, gosh, I could never do that. That's just too much, too far away, too hard. Does anyone ever feel like that? Or is that, you know, right, we can go there. So let's come down on the inspirational side rather than on this is hopeless side. Because it's really, I think, important, and this is where I want to go with this now, to have a sense of what's really possible, what the teachings are about. As the Buddha said, if it were not possible, I would not ask you to do so. He says that again and again. So we think, yeah, possible for the all the people listen to him. They had a Buddha. We're stuck, you know, here with us. But if it were not possible, I would not ask you to do so. Letting that in and letting it really inspire us, feed our sense of aspiration of what's possible, just to open our mind and heart. And you should tune into whatever your own aspiration is. But I think over the years, I've found it more and more important and supportive to, again and again for myself, tune into aspiration, but not do the false humble thing. You know, yeah, well, I just have an aspiration. Maybe it'll be a little bit better, you know, after I practice. Maybe I won't want as much, and that's about all I could hope for. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about really embracing in some way the vastness, the possibility. Because if we meet this with aspiration rather than, you know, oh, it's impossible, it really can feed us. It can give us energy. It can give us strength. It can give us the willingness to go on. So I just wanted not to be... urge you all not to be afraid of really honoring in yourself the vastness of aspiration, of opening to what's possible. And as the Buddha said, I'm not going to read the whole sutta, it's long, but he said, where did I write it down? I wrote it down somewhere. I know it by heart, but anyway. He said the heartwood, the cause, the reason for this path is the ending of this path is the sure heart's release, the steadfastness of the mind and heart that's no longer shaken by greed, hatred, delusion. And it's a long sutta where he talks about the power of virtue, the power of concentration, the power of all kinds of different insights, and they're all wonderful. But he basically says, don't stop there. That's not the ending of the path. But the unshakable deliverance of heart, that is the heartwood. That is the reason for the whole path. And he says, don't be satisfied with less. Don't be satisfied with less. That's not saying get into a craving, frustrated quality of mind. But he says again in another place, this is the Buddha, two things he never lost sight of in his practice before he became a Buddha. One is not to shrink from the struggle, he called it, from the path, from, you know, all the things that we confront in our heart and mind on the way. Not to shrink from it, and not to rest contented merely with wholesome states of mind. Not to rest contented merely with wholesome states of mind. I don't know how that lands with you, but I say that's a trap I fall into frequently, right? I mean, some of the wholesome states of mind are beautiful, profound. Metta's one, really strong state of metta. It's beautiful. It does move into... it kind of partakes of the wisdom of no self, of the limitless quality of heart and mind. But aren't there times when the metta just feels really good and we think, okay, maybe we don't actually think of it. I could live like this. That would be good enough. It's a heck of a lot better than how I've been living. Okay. You know, and go out, or it could be more subtle than that. But like, it's been such a struggle, and now things are more mellow. That's really pretty good. So just to, not to get into any kind of negativity, but just to notice, if this speaks to you, you may say, I really am quite satisfied with wholesome states of mind. That could be true for you. We have to really look and see what's true for us. I'm not telling you what you should want or what you should feel. I'm just trying to offer what the Buddha says and what really inspires me to keep going, because it's a whole life. Because the thing with the wholesome states of mind, I'm sure you know, especially after reading about the First Noble Truth, not going to last. No way. Something's going to happen. Sooner rather than later, probably, but something's going to happen. And so in a way, that's great because it throws us back. Okay, right. If there's times when I get a little bit complacent. Do you know what complacent means? Kind of, yeah, things are good and it's okay. My mind's equanimous. I don't think I've got it all licked, but it's pretty good. And there's just not quite the completeness of being willing to meet experience with awareness. Yeah, it's okay. It's fine. A little bit on the surface, you know. And yeah, something always happens. And when the thing first happens, whatever it is, it could be something just little, like, you know, you just wake up and have a bad day. It can be something that really affects your life. Someone you love dearly dies or whatever. Something's going to happen. And the first moment, I'm not saying, oh, great, this is waking me up again. No, I can't say that's the first reaction. But soon, I could say up until now, you never know, but up until now, at some point, everything really difficult that's happened in my life, and I haven't had a really tough life, but we all have difficult stuff. At some point, I really see how that, of course, that's part of the path. Because everything, every moment of our life is part of our path. And at some point, I always see how that woke up the energy, that inspired more presence, more willingness to explore. Another statement of the Buddha's, take the result of dukkha, the result of experiencing dukkha in ourselves is it ripens, you know, like fruit ripens, either as a bewilderment. Bewilderment is a very nice word in English. It means like confusion, like really delusion. Bewilderment's like, huh? What? What was that? What happened? Bewilderment. It ripens either as bewilderment, confusion, or search. So when dukkha ripens as search, that means that becomes the inspiration to really bring awareness, present moment awareness, into this moment's experience, into what we're calling suffering. See, what's going on here? Not aversion to get rid of it, but to really look and see what's going on here. So the sense of aspiration, really consciously, I find for myself, remembering, tuning in, has been and continues to be an enormous energetic support in continuing to come back again and again to the path. And it's wholesome. So I want to just mention how I can experience and we can explore the difference between aspiration, the sense of it's really possible to completely free the heart and mind. That could be aspiration or that could be complete craving. The same words, the same idea, because it's always about what's the quality in our heart, in our mind. So whatever aspiration is, it feeds sadha, faith. Which in the way it's talked about in the suttas, faith is a mental quality, an energetic mental quality we can feel. So when I'm saying faith, sada, the Pali word, I don't mean faith in a belief or the Buddha or something like that, but that the aspiration brings faith. You can feel it's an energy that uplifts the mind, the heart. It kind of brightens the mind, it strengthens the mind and heart. It brings this energy, or as Upandita defined faith, it gives us the willingness to do, the energy to show up again, the energy to keep on practice. It gives resolve. And so you can feel it's a wholesome, uplifting, brightening quality of heart and mind when we're connecting with what's aspiration in that way for us. But being normal human beings, there'll be most likely many times that it shifts from aspiration to some form of wanting, some form of greed. And a lot of times people will ask, well, how can you have the aspiration to be free without it being this sense of always striving, looking forward, wanting? And so we can feel in ourselves, we can learn to tell the difference. Because the wanting is really, instead of feeling that brightness, that uplift, that gives us the energy to land with awareness right here, when it's wanting, yes, it's like we have one eye on the goal, or maybe both eyes on the goal, and we're not here at all. But it's like, how can I be free? And the sense of wanting brings in that sense of measurement, as I spoke about the other night. Immediately there's the goal, and there's me here, and they're far away from each other. But even if they're close, there's still that and me, the sense of measurement, the narrowness, because greed is only interested in what it wants. And so it's the looking out and the sense of frustration, of disappointment or discouragement. When any of that's arising in our heart mind, you say, but it's the same aspiration, but it's morphed into a different state of mind and heart. It's morphed into wanting. It's morphed into greed. And as the Buddha said in the Second Noble Truth, that's the source of suffering. And we're suffering right then. Oh, I'll never be free. I'll never be able to do that. I'm so bad. All of that sense of discouragement, that's the clue. That's the clue that tanha, wanting, is the quality in the heart and mind rather than aspiration. Oh, that's interesting. So it's the same process you've all been doing in the metta, noticing the difference between the simple friendliness and when we want something from it. And this is what we just keep learning, right? Because this is a habit of our minds. We don't hate it. We've nothing personal about it, but learning to tell the difference. So the sense of reconnecting, though, with our aspiration again and again, and then, of course, all these difficult things will come up, not just the discouragement in the aspiration, but all the stuff that happens in life. All the, never mind life, let's just look at this next week. Stuff's going to come up, never mind about in life. If you're just sitting there and it's nice, 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 okay, you'll tell us about it, and may it be so. But, you know, you're minding your own business, and you'll be bored, and your back will hurt, and you'll be filled with fear, and you'll just get angry at the way somebody walked across the path, you know, whatever it is. Stuff's going to happen. Memories from when you were three. I don't know what it's going to be. Something's going to happen. Because that's also dukkha. It just never stops going. Something's going to happen. And some of it you won't like. Pretty sure. Some of it will be unpleasant. And pretty sure you won't be balanced in awareness every moment, and aversion and wanting will come up. If it doesn't, let us know. So this is... these moments are the really valuable moments of practice. This is our path. And for me, reconnecting to aspiration, reminding myself, again, gives me that brightness, that energy to go, not to make something happen, not to make it be the way we want it to be, but the aspiration that brings into our mindfulness practice is the willingness, the faith, the trust to just relax completely into whatever's occurring in this moment. The practice and our aspiration and our work on the path, it's not to figure out how to get it right. It's not even trying to be a good meditator. You know, it's like to have the faith. Well, then that's what aspiration does for me. Oh, right. It's like this now, the way Ajahn Sumedho talks about it. That phrase helps me a lot. Doesn't help everybody. But when there's some sense of struggle and trying to just figure out what's supposed to happen, how am I supposed to relate to this with mindfulness? Is the mindfulness, I was really present with it, but I didn't do it right somehow. For sure, when you say that, we always know what's coming next. because it didn't go away, right? It didn't go away, so I couldn't have been mindful correctly. Because correct mindfulness means we think what we don't like goes away and everything gets pleasant. Is that what you think secretly in the back of the mind? If you practice right, what's freedom going to feel like? Only pleasant Vedana. Forget it. Forget it. Anyway. So the aspiration isn't looking forward at all. It's like with the most sincere intentions, you know, we want to know a little bit ahead of time what's going to happen, right? At least give us some sense of what the path should look like, which we can give you all kinds of ideas, but then the mind's, okay, well, where am I on it and where should it be going? None of that is awareness practice. Awareness practice is just this, it's the commitment to fully relax, to fully surrender in a way into the unknown of this moment without having any commitment as to what will arise in the next moment. Again and again and again. And I think one of the reasons, at least I find this difficult, in the moment of doing it, it isn't difficult. There's all the fighting and creating and trying to do something in order not to just be with what's happening. When I go, oh, it's like this now. All that other craziness stops. And it's like in that moment, it's a relief. It's peace. Because the resistance and the aversion and the clinging isn't arising anymore. The peace isn't about that things are nice. The peace is about in that moment in the heart-mind, craving and aversion and selfing aren't going on. And so it's not how we're used to thinking, right? It's not always so comfortable, this sense of, you know, we want some little sense of me. But awakening freedom, it's not a self-improvement project. It's not like I get to feel better about myself for being more enlightened. The sense of self is what gets seen through. And so that's really, even in moments, again, in moments when there's not a sense of delusion, there's not a sense of me. And it's peaceful. It's normal. It's just, again, we don't often notice it. But along the way, when we think about that, when we're kind of caught in wanting to know what's going to happen, this can seem a little or a lot uncomfortable, you know, just kind of threatening, no, but just uncomfortable. It's not what we're used to, you know. Our views, our sense of comfort are challenged. And this is our practice. They're challenged moment to moment to moment. But what's so, to me, what I love about this mindfulness, simple awareness practice is that although so much comes up and sometimes it's so challenging, the aspiration just gives us in a moment the trust, the faith, the willingness to do. And all the willingness to do is just to be here right now fully with just this moment, with just this moment, without needing to know anything else about it. This is what I call the everyday simplicity of awareness practice, of mindfulness practice, you know. And it's so, this may not speak to you, but one way I think about it is in general we tend to be more entranced, interested in what's happening, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, thinking, particularly, whatever's going on, how does it feel, what does it mean, how am I relating to it, blah, 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 blah. But really, as we're bringing just the simple mindful awareness, it's like this now, it's like this now, it's like this now. What really gets more and more interesting and trustworthy is the simple mindfulness, the simple awareness itself. So we start to, at least how I experience it, start to kind of to love awareness rather than wanting it. It's like a shift of attitude, you know, when we come in with, try to be mindful, try to get aware, try to make it going. And again, we're shifting into that. It feels like some vega. It feels like urgency. I really want to be free. I really want to know. I'm putting in really sincere effort. And that's true. Everyone here putting in really sincere effort. So many moments, you know. And of course it's going to shift into wanting. But to start to notice, it will, because that's just how, that sense of, oh, I'm trying so hard, and I really, but this is happening, and that is happening, the sense of, oh, just loving the awareness rather than trying to hold on to it or get it or make anything happen. And then it's like whatever's occurring is an opportunity for awareness rather than needing to manipulate the experience to get it. I can't be aware yet because I got to kind of fix this up and get rid of that, and there's too much grief and my foot hurts and whatever it is. And once I get it, wake up. When I finally wake up, I can be aware. Guess what? It's possible to be aware when you're sleepy. It's dull because you're sleepy, but it's still awareness. Awareness isn't always incredibly crystal bright and shining and everything's wonderful. That's another one of our cockamamie ideas. Awareness is just doesn't have anything you can notice, but whatever's occurring, if we're not unconscious, can be aware in that. And so we start to really trust this more, really drop in just the simplicity rather than trying and needing some kind of self-confirmation from how good it is, but just that willingness to meet this moment. Very simple. Give this little story. I've used this before, but it really, I don't know if it works for you, but it gives me a sense of just the simplicity of moment to moment. In a way, it's devotion to just awareness of this moment, whatever is occurring, devotion rather than trying to have, trying to be, or trying to own. So this is, I was in a Ramana Ashrama in Tiruvannamalai in southern India, where Ramana Maharshi lived. And it's a very special place, anyway, by the mountain Arunachal. Anyway, in the ashram, which is very well maintained, really it's a sense of, it's kind of like a monument to him, but more it's a place to really encourage, not just to remember Ramana, but really to encourage one's own investigation and discovery, a self-inquiry and awakening. So it's quite a profound place. But there's one place inside where they have, it's like a big kind of marble place that's called, it's called a samadhi, but it's the place he's buried. And it's in a kind of a chapel. And then in a bigger building where there's like a big hall outside. And so it's a common thing that one does there is just circumambulate the samadhi. Everyone does it at different times of day. And every evening, for about an hour outside, there's chanting. The people who work in the ashram from the president on down do this Vedic chanting. And so watching all the different ways people walk around that samadhi is really interesting. And so my mind makes the simile of all the different ways we can approach trying to wake up, you know, just from some are just negligent chatting with each other as they're walking around. Some are like, oh, you can just feel, you know, I want to wake up, you know. And some are really demonstrative, and some are, you know, all kinds of ways, you know. And me too, but just the sense of me, the person, you could just, okay, I'm projecting at everyone else but me. But you could just see all these different aspects. And then one night, I was there, you just come in and listen to the chanting of the people that work there. And the workers, especially the man who's the president, the guy who runs it, another guy who runs it, kind of the highest people there, they do the chanting, and every evening they go in and you have meals there. Everyone sits in rows on the floor, and the president, the guy who runs it all, they come through and they serve everybody. So that's kind of how they do. So the president was in the chanting, and then it was time to get up and go serve the meal. And I'm projecting, of course. I don't know what was going, but I just watched it. He got up, just so simple. He just got up, walked around the samadhi. No big demonstration, no nothing. Just get up, walk around the samadhi, went and served the dinner. And it just really went in. It's like it's just so simple. There's no making anything of it, or me, or if I do this enough, I'll wait. Nothing. Just get up, go around, go serve the dinner. And I thought, you know, that's really what awareness practice is like. It's really what a retreat can be like. You just get up and brush your teeth and make up your bed and eat and wash and sit and walk. And each moment is equally our path, because this moment is all there is. So we're not brushing my teeth so I can go sit. We're completely missing life. We're completely missing awareness. There's only now whatever's occurring. And so whatever's occurring becomes the pathway into this present moment awareness. It's so simple we can't stand it, you know, our mind's just creating all kinds of stuff. But I love the line from Byron Katie, she's an American kind of teacher, not Buddhist, just loving what is. So I think of that as awareness, not like love, but just awareness of what is, loving what is, just giving ourselves completely to the moment, nothing held back. It's not throwing yourself on the moment. It's just, this is what there is. This is from Dogen Zenji, a great Zen master. Truth is not far away. It is ever present. It is not something to be attained, since not one of your steps leads away from it. When you have thrown off your ideas as to what your mind and body are, original truth will fully appear. Zen is simply the expression of truth. Therefore, longing and striving are not the true attitudes of Zen. If you cannot find the truth right where you are, where else do you expect to find it? So it's like, there's nothing you can do that can take us away from truth if we really start to develop this trust and this love in the simplicity of awareness. And as we get more familiar and trusting of it, we can see the way we practice here is really using all of the six sense doors. Whatever's arising at the six sense doors can become the object, the avenue into awareness in our meditation practice. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, all the physical sensations, and the six, all the mental realm. And sure, when we begin with the instructions tomorrow, we haven't talked about, probably be more, a little more simple, a little more directive to begin, just to help the mind get steady, but not because some experiences are more worth awareness than others, because it's not about the experiences. It's about the steadiness awareness that reveals the truth, which is right here, as Dogen Zenji said. So when you start to trust it, you start to see that anything that's happening can be the avenue back into awareness when we've been lost, no matter how long we've been lost. So I'll give you a simple example I had written down from myself a couple of years ago. Just really simple, but to give you a sense. So I was at home, and I was washing my teacup. And I have, like, back in the States, two teacups. I'm a tea junkie. They're the perfect ones. I bought them in Augsburg and shipped them home because they're perfect. I couldn't replace them. So I washed them carefully. But I was washing them sort of aware, but really it was totally out of greed. You know, I'm being really careful, but it was totally greed that was the motivation in the mind. So I was being mindfulness, but then I became aware of the greed. So just being aware of the greed, not that it shouldn't be there. So the greed was really the object of awareness at that moment, and just kept on being with it without thinking anything. Oh, yeah, I'm really greedy right now. I love this cup. But the awareness just starts to deepen and spread out. And as the awareness and the trust out of a lot of practice, the love for awareness, I could say, kind of springs up more stronger than the greed for the cup. And the awareness just started to spread out. And the awareness got really strong. The mindfulness got really strong of just what was going on in my body and everything else. So the greed was like a fine experience to open up to steady, deeper awareness. So I use that because it's so simple. It's something that happens all the time. And you really see there's nothing that occurs that you need to say, oh, this has to go away so I can be aware. As soon as we recognize, oh, well, yeah, awareness. It's like this. So this is really our practice. We start to develop more faith, more trust, more interest in the awareness, and we get a little less fascinated by our reactions and stories about everything that's happening. To me, one of the reasons, some of you have seen this last week, all the stuff that goes on in our minds, all the thoughts. You know how much we believe them in our daily life? How many moods and emotions come? Do you have a sense of how, when we're not aware in our daily life, how much we're run by all these moods and emotions? I mean, no wonder we're exhausted. And everything that happens, I like this, I don't like this, what does it mean about me? What does it mean about them? Is this going to keep happening? How can I stop it? And it's like, oh my God. You know, you wonder why you come here and you're exhausted, how we live our lives. We start to get a little less entranced by all of that. The mind still does it, but we just take it a little less personally and appreciate the awareness more. But all we're doing here is just this simple moment-to-moment bringing awareness, mindfulness to what's occurring just as it is in this moment. And yeah, there's plenty of moments that are difficult, painful, scary. Plenty of times, well, this is easy to say, but plenty of times when we don't even remember awareness or the thought of really surrendering fully into what's happening, just what's happening seems too painful, too scary, too unpleasant, or too pleasant. You don't want to surrender into it because it might go away. But where that's not our go-to response. So this is where when we see, oh, we're all caught up again. Yeah, how do we keep finding? How do I keep finding, keep reminding myself, keep discovering the courage, you know, the wisdom and the humility to keep starting again, to keep re-inspiring myself. And okay, right, I'm all caught up. How can I get in touch with my aspiration again? This is where aspiration has been so helpful to me. And so one is remembering that everything that's arising now is the path. Everything. There's nowhere else we could be than this moment. And another, again, is getting in touch with aspiration, but sometimes we can't access it from inside ourselves. And that's when I find lately more and more helpful to bring in outside into our mind, remind ourselves of outside inspirational things. Sort of Fred's talk last night, for those of you who were here, he spoke about three really inspirational scholar bodhisattvas that inspire him and can inspire many people. We each may have different, people or things that inspire us. And I think that can really be, I find it really helpful as a way to touch again, because when it inspires us, something that this person has done or been or just brings up, remember, it's bringing up that quality in ourself. It's not that they're so wise, they're so generous, they're a real bodhisattva, they're so wonderful, I'm a piece of garbage. That's not inspiring. But when we touch into it, like when Fred was talking about Shanti Deva and that sense of, you know, how brilliant he was, how committed he was to compassion, if it touches you, it's because it's touching that quality in yourself, in your own heart mind. And I just find it more and more helpful to do this, not to think we have to do it all ourselves, some isolated being, because we're not isolated beings. So I just give you two personal examples for me. You find what works for you at different times and don't hesitate, because again, it brings us back to faith, to sadha, to willingness to do that uplifting. Just a little one. I have a photograph of a monk, a bhikkhu I know in the Sagaing Hills in Upper Burma. He, and every year when we go to Burma, go and visit him. and Ujjayanta is his name. He's just this simple, quiet monk, the head of a small monastery in the hills. Do you know him, Ujjayanta? He's just up above Chaswa there at Parekama. And he's not like someone who says a lot or has this brilliance in terms of teaching, but he has the most peaceful metta vibe. And so I've been on, did a couple of one-month self-retreats this year, and I have all different pictures, but his is the one I grabbed to put on my altar. And it's just when I look at it, I'm thinking of him now, I just get cooled out. I mean, I think we've known him and visited him 10 years, probably over 10 years, once a year. He doesn't seem to age. Okay, I'm sure he's aging, but he's friendly, he's polite. He just has this metta vibe. He's so peaceful. He's so chilled out. And so I just think of that, and it gets me back in touch with that space in my own mind heart. And then the last one I'll mention, and I mentioned this in Germany last week or 2 weeks ago. You can find it anywhere. It doesn't have to be a Buddhist monk. This is definitely not a Buddhist monk, just to tell you. It doesn't have to be. A friend of mine, an older woman, she's 92 now, and I was visiting her last November. This is a woman who in her 50s came into the Dharma, got really, really involved with the Dharma. She's really one of the most profound yoginis, meditators that we know. She probably sat maybe 10 3-month retreats in a row, but really, really profound practice and incredible generosity. But she's a woman who had a very rich, full life. I mean, very sophisticated life. She was married to someone who taught at Harvard. She was a hostess. She did all kinds of things. So it's not like she had some life. So when she got involved with the Dharma, she got completely involved, but she still had her whole family and her whole life going on. And so, now she's 92, living in, actually now she's in hospice. Her heart is weak, but when I saw her in November, she wasn't, living in a small, very nice assisted living we call in the state, we call here Altersheim, but where she had her little apartment and people would come in and help clean, but she could kind of cook and do stuff on her own. So I just went to visit and talk to her. And again, she's like so much wisdom, very simple. And she was saying, and she said to other people, I know she meant it. She's someone who's just very honest and simple and direct. She always has been. And if anything now, she's softer. Like she seemed to be a little severe before. But now she would say things to me like, oh, your socks are so cute. I really like them. I never would have, had her say something like that. But anyway, the point is, she's having this very simple life in this small two-room place. And she said to me, this is the most interesting time of my life. I said, really? What do you mean? She said, well, it's like whatever I'm doing, this is it. This is the whole of my life. When I walk across the room to the teapot, totally here. This is it. Walking across the room is my whole life. And when I'm pouring the water into the teapot, it's just totally here. This is everything. It's so interesting. It's so fascinating. And so she's the kind of person that would 100% mean that, just saying it in a very simple way. It was so inspiring. Because, of course, she had a lot of physical stuff wrong with her. So just before I left the state, she was in hospice with a weak heart, but her mind really clear. I didn't see her, but a couple of good friends did. And they said, yeah, she still said that. She said they went in, and she goes, this is the most interesting time of my life. And she was bright and present and caring and really inspirational to me. Just someone simple, dedicated to waking up, just living her life. So when I think of that, I think, yeah, okay. Can this moment be the most interesting time of my life? It's the only moment we have. What's there to wait for? So finding your aspiration and don't settle for anything less. So thanks for listening. Let's just sit quietly a moment.